Back in 1949, writing in his book, The Sand County Almanac, Aldo Leopold coined the phrase, thinking like a mountain. It's his way of trying to respect the natural world. He says, only the mountain has lived long enough to listen objectively to the howl of a wolf as it echoes from ridgetop to ridgetop. Only by thinking like a mountain can we grasp the interconnected forms of life around a mountain. He recalls a turning point from his early life. With a group, he was having lunch on an outcrop of rock on a mountain. They looked down and watched a mother wolf and her pack of grown pups swim across the river and frolic on the rocks. He writes, in those days, we had never heard of passing up a chance to kill a wolf. And with excitement, they raised their rifles and shot them all. Then, he says, we reached the old wolf in time to watch a fierce green fire dying in her eyes. I realized then and have known ever since that there was something new to me in those eyes, something known only to the wolf and the mountain. Writing in Repentance, he recalls, I was young then and full of trigger itch. I thought that because fewer wolves meant more deer, that no wolves would mean deer hunter's paradise. In the years that followed, state after state killed off their wolf populations. Without natural predators, deer populations expanded, consuming every edible brush and seedling, shearing leaves off the trees on the hills. The fast growth of the deer population wasn't good for the deer either. It led to starvation, says Leopold, who observed many of their sun-bleached bones. While a deer pulled down by wolves can be replaced in 2 or 3 years, he says, a range of trees pulled down by too many deer may not be replaced in 2 or 3 decades. Leopold says that our governments were not thinking like a mountain whenever we allowed the overgrazing of cattle on the hills of mountains. From such ignorance, he says, we have dust bowls and rivers washing the future into the sea. Leopold's epiphany, his turning point, was that moment of connection with a wolf whose life he was taking. A humbling moment. In such a humble spirit, he went on to learn and explain to others the big picture of our mutual dependence with other forms of life. It is part of our human nature that we can grasp the big picture, imagine the perspective of the ecosystem of a mountain. We can take the time to imagine the mountain's ancient, nearly eternal perspective, or the perspective of an ocean, or a river delta, or a coastal marsh. But for too much of the time, we humans are thinking more like dinosaurs. We are doing what we're doing, looking for our next meal, next home, next meeting place, next resting place, next watering hole, all the while not realizing the disasters on their way, which will give us no resting place and will rob us of our watering holes. Like dinosaurs, we worry about a threat just beyond a tree and ignore the greater perils coming towards us. This morning, I won't get into policy recommendations regarding climate change. After all, one of our favorite climate science experts will be giving a talk over lunch here today. And given all the facts that he can bring to us, I won't fill my sermon with statistics about the perils of the planet. For many of us, it's enough merely to mention the wiped out rainforests and coral reefs, the spoiling of mountaintops for mining in Appalachia, the drought and wildfires, the collapsing glaciers, thawing of permafrost, and melting away of ice flows. It is all enough to make us weep. Wendell Berry is a poet, farmer, and activist in Kentucky. He has put his poetry, his faith, and his body into the fight against coal mining by mountaintop removal. 2 summers ago, when the General Assembly of our Unitarian Universalist Association took place in Louisville, Kentucky, we UUs held an afternoon rally overlooking the Ohio River. Berry was among the local activists who spoke. We also heard from Appalachian families enduring loss of homes and community, and from people suffering diseases brought on by the toxins of the mining operations. I must confess, though I had been concerned about global warming, I had known little about the damage that coal mining has done. I was thinking about the gases let off by the burning of coal, not about the mining of it. In an earlier interview, Berry says, "You can go to a little stream that's coming down off the mountain, and you know that one day that stream ran clear, and you could have knelt down and drunk from it without any hesitation. It would have been clean, and now it's running orange or black." And what people have to understand is that there's heartbreak in that. He says, "Tears beyond understanding have been shed over this by people who loved their land and have had to sit there and see it destroyed. Weeping and lamenting is called for, and it can be helpful when facing the facts." According to Joanna Macy, a Buddhist and environmental activist, our fears and anxieties can paralyze us if we don't express them. We can avoid our feelings and avoid acting. We can be tempted to isolate our hearts from the despair. This is why the global warming crisis is a spiritual matter as well as a scientific one. For it was the isolation of the human heart from our place in the natural world that enabled human beings to bring ourselves to this place of crisis. The Hebrew poets of the book of Genesis predicted our powerful place in the world pretty well. In Genesis, God says to the humans, "And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth, and upon every fowl of the air, and upon all that moveth on the earth, and upon all the fishes of the sea. Into your hands are they delivered." Such an accurate prediction, one with tragic results. But not only the fish and fowl and beasts of the earth are dreading the hand of human power. All of us have cause to fear what our human family has been doing on this earth and to this earth. 3 years ago, in the capital city of Kentucky, Wendell Berry and 13 others waged a sit-in at the office of the governor. Berry says, "We ought to have done this 50 years ago. This has been going on that long, half a century. The damage from the beginning has been excessive. It's now grown from excessive to extreme." After 4 full days and nights of their sit-in, their governor agreed to visit the residents of the mountaintop communities. However, even the visit did not change his mind. He still made the claim that surface mining could be done without harming the local environment. In spite of government inaction, Wendell Berry says, people around the state are getting in touch with us, and there's activity going on in support of this effort. What will happen tomorrow, what will happen after tomorrow, we don't know. But all of us who are interested in stopping this terrible damage and this terrible oppression of people will go on and on. Berry points out the motivation of the moral principle of neighborliness. He says, one of the deepest, most urgent instructions that we receive from our cultural tradition is the imperative to be a good neighbor. And this is ignored as an official policy by the coal companies, and therefore by their government allies. What outrages him about the policies he's fighting, the need for a spirit of neighborliness, is the same thing that motivates his demonstrations, the presence of that spirit. Henry David Thoreau was a friend of the Massachusetts Unitarians in the mid-1800s. Thanks to his writings, Thoreau is famous as a nature lover and spiritual mystic. Writing in his journal in 1851, he says, "My heart leaps into my mouth at the sound of the wind in the woods. I, whose life was but yesterday so desultory and shallow, suddenly recover my spirits, my spirituality, through my hearing. Ah, if I could so live that there should be no desultory moments in my life." Thoreau was also a social critic and a radical. Perhaps his spiritual refreshments gave him the courage to fight against slavery, defend the cause of the native inhabitants of North America, and oppose our war with Mexico in 1848. His time in jail led to the essay, Civil Disobedience, an essay which he originally titled Resistance to Civil Government. His words have inspired the civil disobedience campaigns of Mohandas K. Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., and Bill McKibben, the Vermont environmentalist and leader in climate change activism. 1 week from today is the People's Climate March in New York City. It will coincide with the United Nations meeting about climate change. Some folks I know back east are headed there, and a few Sacramento activists are going by train. Events in solidarity with the People's Climate March will take place around the nation and in 130 countries around the globe next weekend. Speaking to a group in Sacramento last Friday evening, the British climate activist George Marshall says that you cannot predict the results of a protest gathering. He says even a large rally and march may not really change policies directly, but such large gatherings do change the people who participate in them. A rally, march, or festival can be an occasion for learning, connecting, and building coalitions. Furthermore, by participating with others, we can revive our passion, restore hope, and feel the sense of belonging to something larger than ourselves. We gain courage to say what's on our hearts, to show up, to give money or time, to write letters, to vote, and to stay connected to others. We gain inspiration to change our own habits. We grow in spirit. Am I concerned about the planet? You bet I am. A small example of how I've been obsessed about energy conservation. I exercise daily at the Central YMCA. And for a long time, quietly, I have steamed about an amazing waste of water by many of my fellow YMCA users in the showers and restroom. Finally, I made a suggestion to the executive director. Now, signs in the showers proclaim, in consideration of the drought, please limit your shower time. Above the sinks, it says, please conserve water. Thank you for your consideration. A small example, doesn't make me look obsessed, but let me tell you, I can get distracted by a wastebasket anywhere. I'm reaching in the trash to retrieve items disposed of in the wrong place and moving them to the recycling bin. More than once, I have leaned over into a nearly empty gray plastic trash bin to reach a bottle or a box in the bottom that belonged in recycling.
We're almost falling in.
Or tipped it over. At my apartment, there's only a window air conditioner, and it's in the living room. I try not to use it. Most summer nights, I don't go home until the Delta breeze has begun cooling the air. On arrival at my furnace-like apartment, I open the windows and turn on the window fans and the ceiling fans. I might go out for a walk or a beer until it cools down. If it stays warm, I go to bed with a wet washcloth over my face, and I wonder why I'm still single. Since my apartment building has no compost bin, I have started saving compostable kitchen waste, and so it doesn't rot like Kevin's backyard in his childhood. I put it in the freezer, and once a week or so I take it to our compost bins at UUSS on Sierra Boulevard when I go to the office. On the days leading up to that delivery, if you were to open my freezer, you would scratch your head at the sight of melon rinds, broccoli stems, apple cores, and old brown lettuce with rigor mortis. I can be obsessive, as I said. I can get upset. I get worried. I get angry about the situation. I get resentful. But then I remember. Thinking like a mountain. This means not only seeing the connections of our lives with all other forms of life on Earth. It means being still. It means listening, whether hearing the howl of a wolf or the song of birds, or feeling the breeze or your own heartbeat. Thinking like a mountain. A mountain has the long view, a very long view. A mountain is perhaps the closest thing to eternity we can rest our eyes on or put our feet on. The sense of eternity it conveys is reassuring, calming, humbling. When Henry David Thoreau sauntered around the small corner of the planet, which he called home, he wrote this: "Oh, if I could live so that in each season, when some part of nature especially flourishes, then a corresponding part of me may not fail to flourish." He goes on wondering, "What if I could pray aloud or to myself as I went along by the brookside, a cheerful prayer like the birds? There is yet more joy." He says, "For joy I could embrace the earth." There is yet more joy to be had, more life on this earth to embrace and celebrate. The stakes are high. The facts are daunting. The other night, activist and author George Marshall admitted that to us. Doubt or frustration or despair will be a common experience, and an understandable one. Marshall says we need to be open to each other and to help each other through the frustration and through the despair. He urges us to bring up climate change and its human causes in conversations and to end the silence that surrounds it. To be brave and speak our truth. To be loving and speak the values that motivate us. The values of common humanity, protecting communities, and caring for others. neighborliness. You draw people to this movement, he says, or to any movement or any organization, by this simple example of the joy and friendship that you have with people who share your passion. People will see your joy and your social connection, and they will want to be part of it. Next Sunday, during the People's Climate March, hundreds of thousands of people may or may not be thinking like a mountain. Yet it is my hope that those New York marchers and those people showing solidarity around the world and those of us watching online or on television will find ourselves thinking once more like neighbors, like relatives, like part of a whole human family, like members of the circle of life on this earth. So may it be for all of us, everywhere. Blessed be, and amen.